Welcome to the Badlands, that overlooked place where philosophical thought runs into the political concerns of the day.
Hello and welcome to the Badlands Politics and Philosophy Podcast. I'm Toby Napolitano, coming to you from the outer circles of flu and sinus hell. Recently upgraded from the inner circles. I actually sound great today by standards of the past few days.
I figured, who is this again?
I don't want to talk about it. It's been a rough week. And also with us, you can hear our New Hampshire primary correspondent, Michael Hughes.
Oh, Jesus Christ. That's pretty much the last title I want.
Yeah, that's like happening like next week in your town, right?
Basically right outside my doorstep. I cannot leave my doorstep without running into a stage of some sort for a political rally.
Open your window and you just hear, the top 0.1%. I actually kind of sound like him right now. I can kind of pull that off. Anyways.
You should have just pretended that that's who we were interviewing.
That's true.
You've ruined this.
That would have been a worthwhile gamble for this podcast, I think. Anyways. So forgive me, listeners. I'm getting over, as I said, a pretty nasty flu and sinus deal. But we wanted to start talking about the Democratic primaries, which just officially got underway in Iowa and are already completely insane. And there's actually less certainty about what's going to happen. There's less certainty about what's going to happen than there was before Iowa. So maybe we should
I think it's better to say there's less certainty about what's going to happen in Iowa.
That's true. I mean, so maybe we should just give a quick kind of overview of the state of the primary. Also what the primary is. We have a lot of many, many, many non-American listeners. We have some, okay? And we should, you know, explain
we have
these
one.
Things.
All right.
No, that's not true.
No, you're right. You're right.
So at least five. So where do we start?
I wish Hannah was here to explain to us right. How the alternatives work.
Well, she would just say, well, our election season lasts about 6 months, or sorry, 6 weeks, and you're forbidden to campaign before that. To which I think we have a valid response, which is that, like, look, New Zealand's small. We have over 300 million people, and there is at least some reason for having it be longer because candidates do want to campaign, talk to people from different states. Anyways, the Democratic primary is the process by which the Democratic nominee is selected to run in the general election for president, which will happen later this year. The process, it differs from the general election in a number of important ways. First of all, the voting is sequential. It happens over the course of basically 4 months between the start of February and early June. Starting with Iowa and New Hampshire, and then eventually ending with, is it like the Virgin Islands and Marianas? I don't know.
Right? Oh, I didn't come prepared for this.
Every week or 2 weeks, a handful of states will vote, and the race will kind of be updated. The other important thing to note is that it is largely proportional. So if a candidate gets, you know, doesn't win, quote unquote, win a state, but they get, say, 20%, then they will roughly get 20% of the delegates from that state. The caveat being that if you are below 15%, I think in a precinct within a state, then you don't get any delegates. So, or it could be state level. I don't think it's state level. I don't know. It's a little bit complicated. It's basically proportional. So how are people doing so far? Well, the front runner up until Iowa and in the national polls was former Vice President Joe Biden, Vice President to Barack Obama. He's a sort of moderate conservative Democrat. Basically, he appeals to that part of the electorate among Democrats. And then in second, maybe 4 or 5 percentage points behind him in the national polls have been Bernie Sanders, followed by Elizabeth Warren and Pete Buttigieg. So what happened in Iowa, Michael?
Does anybody know?
I don't know.
I mean, do you want me to talk about the software issues? Because that's where most of the action was. So yeah, what happened in Iowa? I mean, I think last time I checked, 97% of the
results are in.
The numbers, yeah.
And this is several days after the voting took place. Typically, you get it the same night. It's part of the shit show aspect get of it.
100% yeah. by the end of the night. Yeah.
Yeah.
So it looks like Pete Buttigieg, he came in first. Right now, he's in first place when it comes to the actual delegates that he will take.
This is where it's actually a little bit complicated and not exactly proportional, but it's close to proportional.
right.
Yeah.
He's losing the popular vote right. in the state by about 3,000 or 2,000 to 3,000 votes.
6,000.
Oh, 6,000 now?
Yeah.
So by a considerable number, relatively.
Yeah.
And yet he's like three delegates ahead, some tiny number of delegates ahead.
Yeah. Now, and this is the thing we want to talk about. I mean, one question is like, if it's proportional, why does it matter? People are really focusing on, well, did Buttigieg technically win or did Sanders technically win? And in a proportional contest, you might say, who cares? They're each going to get basically right. the same number of delegates, which is what is relevant for actually getting the nomination. And the reason it cares, and in particular, we should say, Iowa is a pretty small, not very populous state. It's worth, I think, 41 or 44 delegates. The number doesn't really matter. Because there's a total of more than 4,000 delegates to be had. So it's like 1%.
And so the number of actual people who vote in the primary is an even tinier.
Yeah. Yeah. It's a very small number. Mathematically speaking, Iowa and likewise New Hampshire, which is the second state, don't matter that much. And yet there's an incredible amount of focus on the outcomes of Iowa and New Hampshire. From a mathematical standpoint, you'd be like, why? So like in particular, Joe Biden did very poorly in Iowa, did much worse than expected. And so everyone's sort of starting to say Joe Biden, who was taken to be the front runner and still leads in national polls, which should be the most kind of predictive thing that we have about overall performance in the primary. Everyone's kind of saying, oh, he might be screwed. But again, mathematically, it's like, but why? Iowa doesn't matter, right? It's really not worth much. And the reason is, it turns out, or a lot of people are saying, it's just really, really, like, there's this notion of momentum is invoked, right? Which is a very mysterious notion that's invoked both in politics and, like, sports, right? This idea of momentum. It's something that I think people are often rightly sort of wary of, or at least I am, certainly in sports.
See, I think it makes a little more sense in sports than
really.
And well, to be clear, that it makes more sense in sports in the sense that there might actually be a phenomenon where one team has figured something out, and they figured out how to beat another team.
Okay, but then you're offering an alternative explanation for their success. It's not like there's this force of momentum and they have it, and
no,
that explains.
No, it's grounded in something else. That's true. But there's at least sensible to talk about it. In the case of politics, it's an entirely externally manufactured thing, right? Like, it doesn't seem to me that Buttigieg has figured out how to beat Bernie Sanders in the national election.
Or Joe Biden.
Or Joe Biden, or figured out a way to win, right? It's actually just an external thing that occurs when the media pays as much attention to that candidate and lauds that candidate as much as they have post-Iowa.
Yeah. So just to give you a sense of the importance of these results, Joe Biden, and I'm just going by a 538's model as far as I know. It's one of the better sort of forecast models for judging the probability or the likelihood that a particular candidate is going to win. Before the Iowa caucus, given Biden's 4 or 5% national poll lead, I think he was considered the front runner with about a 40% chance of winning the overall nomination. Bernie Sanders was second with about, I don't know, 20%, something like that. Since this tiny Iowa caucus result, without requisite changes in the national polling, because they're not out yet, they have the odds of Biden winning down to 17% and Bernie up to 49%, who is now taken to be the front runner. That's amazing.
Yeah.
It's startling. I'm actually surprised by that. I'm wondering if that'll get dialed back. But anyways, and everyone accepts this. Everyone seems to know, including the candidates going in, we have to do well in this tiny, not very populous state that mathematically doesn't seem to matter, but as far as narrative goes, matters tremendously. And the thing we actually wanted to talk about was, for this episode, because of this, and probably because Iowa didn't favor the party favorite, Biden, this time around, there's been a lot of articles sort of complaining about this fact about Iowa and arguing that Iowa shouldn't go first, right? Iowa should not have this outsized influence. And in a lot of cases in particular, because it's not a particularly representative state, it's not just that it's small, it's disproportionately white compared to the Democratic electorate as a whole, disproportionately non-urban, and disproportionately old. And so the complaint is basically, because of Iowa's outsized importance, it kind of skews the whole Democratic nomination process in favor of those demographics, which are not representative of the Democratic electorate. And so I guess we kind of wanted to assess this. Like, what do we think about this? Is it true that Iowa has this effect? Yes, it seems so. And then is it unfair? Is it unfair to some groups? And I guess, you know, we can kind of spitball about, like, what are some alternatives? What could be done about it?
That's the big thing is, what can you do as an alternative that would be fairer to everybody?
Right.
And most of these articles that you've mentioned, they have suggestions, but they're usually to pick other small states that are at least more representative in terms of racial demographics. And the suggestion is, well, even if you are allowing for small states to win, at least they're not going to be sort of demographically skewed in the way that they presently are.
So, for instance, one of the pieces I wanted to focus on was a piece from the New York Times opinion writer David Leonhardt, who writes, the article is titled, Iowa Should Never Go First Again, and the subheading is, the current system is a form of white privilege that warps the process. Interesting.
I think there are two components to that. I think all of America is going to agree after this with the initial thesis for sure, right?
Part because of the procedural problems that they've had. Right. Yeah,
exactly. With the interesting sort of philosophical stuff is in the latter part.
Right? Yes. Although I wonder, should we pause? I mean, as a Mainer, you are in a position to explain to us what the heck a caucus is. Because these are actually fairly rare. There are, strictly speaking, there are primaries and there are caucuses. At a primary, it's like any old, you know, voting day. You go to a voting place and you place your vote and you leave. A caucus is not like that, and as a result, I think first of all the turnout is lower than you get in a primary, and second of all, the results can be a bit weirder.
The whole process is much weirder. I have to confess, I'm getting old now, I guess. It's been over a decade since I was voting in Maine. So it's been a very long time since I participated in a Maine caucus, and it's possible that some of the procedural stuff has changed since I participated. But it does sound like Iowa, the way they do it, is similar to what I experienced, which was basically you start out the process by essentially getting into a big cafeteria or gymnasium or someplace that can hold a lot of people, and you start talking. People are provided the opportunity to talk about the candidates that they favor. And then you kind of have an initial grouping where people will essentially go stand by the person who's designated as the representative for the candidate that you prefer. And so you can get an initial sense of just how many people are going to be in favor of different candidates. It allows for, it's one of the nice things about it, the proportional representation process in general, where you, and in some ways it gives you kind of ranked choice voting opportunity, because you can say, oh, I'm going to initially go stand over by the Green Party candidate, or you can't do that for the Democratic Party, obviously, but you can say, like, I'm going to go stand over by Andrew Yang's group. Because I like that candidate, even though you know there's almost no chance that they're going to end up with any delegates. And you can at least see how many delegates they potentially have. And then there's an opportunity for you to change your mind. And there's a next stage of the process where you can say, okay, well, now I'll go to a more viable candidate who would be my next best choice for to this particular candidate. And again, people, the floor is open for people to speak on behalf of their candidate. And you sort of... you go back and forth and having dialogue about that. How useful that dialogue is probably depends on a lot of things. Yeah. I can't say.
It's interesting from like a philosophical standpoint, right? The caucus, while it is more intensive, kind of tries to exhibit the ideal of deliberative democracy, right? People actually right. getting together and talking it out and trying to give arguments for one side or the other. And of course, as you say, in practice, whether that's, you know, actually approaches that ideal is another question.
I mean, given how complex the divisions are and the amount of time that we spend through social media and other things trying to work these issues out, obviously it's going to be a challenge in a like 1 hour, 2 hour sort of venue where a limited number of people yeah. are going to talk. Anybody who's ever been in a conference call knows the more people you add, the harder it is to actually get through anything. Right. It's like a giant conference call. So it has its issues. But in the end, what you end up doing is people kind of figure out, okay, these are the candidates that are viable and have a chance at landing some representatives. Some people hold out and say, F that. I'm not going to... sort of sacrifice my values for any of these candidates. So I'm going to stick with my candidate just for the sake of, the media narrative that's going to fall out of the decision that, or the numbers that come out from the process. But generally people will go to the candidates that are going to end up with, some delegates, and they'll prefer those. And then you'll end up landing on, you know, the top handful of candidates that meet that 15% threshold or whatever it is to get a kind of proportional number of delegates amongst those who pass that, whatever that threshold is.
Yeah. I think, I don't know this for sure, but I would guess it's, harder to have accurate polling for caucuses than it is for primaries because of, it's a bit more of a complex,
way more. Yeah.
Yeah. Process there. Okay. Well, thank you for that, Resident Mainer.
Former resident Mainer.
Right, sorry.
I'm New Hampshire correspondent now.
Right. We moved you, I forgot. All right, so let's start talking about the a bit more about the effects of the Iowa caucus, which we said are seemingly quite large, or at least people take them to be quite large. And I guess the first question is just how much of an outsized impact does it have, right? Again, mathematically speaking, Iowa... doesn't really matter. Sorry. But everyone takes it to matter. And then obviously the question will be why. Now, I think we do think, yes, there is reason to think that Iowa does have a really disproportionately large impact on the process. Though I did just want to pick on first a study that was referenced in that piece from David Leonhardt that I mentioned before. Because I thought... So he makes the claim that he cites this study, which says that voters in Iowa have up to 20 times the influence of late voters in the selection of candidates. So people in Iowa have that much more of an influence than, say, people in what's a state that goes late, like Hawaii or New Jersey or something. I think it's fairly late. So I had a look at the study because I was curious. I was like, damn, that's a lot. Again, considering how tiny the delegate count is for Iowa. And I want to just... I don't think this study gives good evidence for it. I think we can have better evidence for it. But I actually just want to read this abstract to you and see if anything sticks out as being a little fishy. Okay, this is 2007. Paper's called Momentum and Social Learning in Presidential Primaries. Brian Knight and Nathan Schiff. This paper provides an investigation of the role of momentum in social learning and sequential voting systems. In the econometric model, voters are uncertain over candidate quality, and voters in late states attempt to infer the information held by those in early states from voting returns. Candidates experience momentum effects when their performance in early states exceeds expectations. The empirical application focuses on the responses of daily polling data to the release of voting returns in the 2004 presidential primary. We find that John Kerry benefited from surprising wins in early states and took votes away from Howard Dean, who held a strong lead prior to the beginning of the primary season. The voting weights implied by the estimated model demonstrate that early voters have up to 20 times the influence of late voters. And interestingly, this is where they kind of make a normative judgment, demonstrating a significant departure from the ideal of one person, one vote. And that was an idea that came up a lot when we were talking about gerrymandering. And so there's a suggestion that the outsized influence of Iowa voters is akin to the unfairness that you might think exists with respect to gerrymandering. I don't think that's right. But we'll get there. But let's just pause. So their data set comes from the 2004 primaries. And in particular, so Howard Dean was leading in the polls coming up to Iowa. And then John Kerry had a surprise win. And Dean finished like third. And then they say, you know, for who knows why, Kerry outperformed Dean the rest of the way. Now, Michael, why might that have happened? What's an alternative explanation that you can think of?
You know, it's funny. That was actually the last time I caucused in Maine.
Okay.
And there was a particular incident that I do remember coming up quite a bit. It seemed like Mr. Dean was a bit too loud, maybe.
So for people who don't know what we're talking about, this is the Dean scream, and I'll play a clip of it right here.
You know something? If you had told us 1 year ago that we were going to come in third in Iowa, we would have given anything for that. And you know something? Not only are we going to New Hampshire, Tom Harkin, we're going to South Carolina and Oklahoma and Arizona and North Dakota and New Mexico. And we're going to California and Texas and New York. And we're going to South Dakota and Oregon and Washington and Michigan. And then we're going to Washington, D.C. to take back the White House.
So the title, this is a CNN YouTube video called 2004, The Scream That Doomed Howard Dean. All right. Another video was called The First Political Meme. And it was a clip of this. Yeah, I mean, everyone widely agrees that his weird kind of yelpy scream not only ruined his chances of becoming president that year, basically ended his political career.
Which is so bizarre when you think
about
it.
It is. I mean, it's not even that crazy.
I don't know what's weirder, that like 1/10 of 1% of the population votes and then the percentages switch by from 20% to 49% for a candidate, or the fact that Howard Dean's enthusiasm when getting off a plane tanked his political career.
I think maybe we've come a long way with respect to crazy shit happening and being said during campaigns, so that at this point, like, if someone did that, it would be like funny on Twitter for a day, but who cares?
Donald Trump's our president.
Exactly. I mean, come on. What the hell, 2004 voters? But anyways,
honestly, they might have been the quality gate that we needed.
Yeah, that's true. Right, there's no mention of this in this study as a possible alternative explanation for what happened. Their preferred explanation relies on this idea of, as I said, candidate quality, which they sort of loosely define as being, or say, as you can think of as being something like competence or integrity, something disassociated from ideology. And their thought is voters... I mean, they're using an econometric model, right? So it's like voters are learning about the quote-unquote quality of the candidate on the basis of their performance in Iowa. And crucially, this is distinct, and they point out, from an alternative explanation, which is maybe like questions about viability or electability, right? Because it could just be that voters in late states vote more strategically, right? Because at that point, the field is very much narrowed down. They're no longer necessarily going to be able to vote for their first choices. So they're kind of stuck with the whatever the viable candidates are at that point. In any case, I don't know how plausible that particular explanation is. I'm not sure if that's how voting goes for people.
Yeah. Well, I certainly think that it complicates the claims about fairness and unfairness, which I think we're going to get to, because exactly that, the idea that you can strategically vote later, in part because you have better information, complicates the claim that the early voters have more power to make a decision about who they're going to elect. I mean, it's certainly true that some voters end up having a more outsized influence, but it's actually not clear that that is true for all, you know, even most Iowa voters.
Right.
Right. Most Iowa voters are not going to get what they want.
Right. Okay, so I didn't find the explanations of that study particularly compelling. However, 538 comes to a similar conclusion studying historical, not just a single case study of 2004, which is a terrible, terrible starting point. But they do find that the results of Iowa are very, very predictive of who's going to win the nomination. And they come up with a similar estimate, which suggests that the influence of Iowa is about 20 times more than its delegate share. So they say roughly it's kind of equivalent to something like 800 delegates, again, out of a total of about 4,000, even though strictly it's worth 40. Now, they also give an explanation for why this is, which I think is more compelling, and that is, as we've kind of been gesturing at, the way the media treats this, which is fascinating. Like, the media both correctly describes and creates the phenomenon.
That's certainly seems like it has to be the predominant cause of why this happens, right? I mean, the only other explanations that seem plausible at all would be financial interests that back candidates might readjust based on early voting.
But you would think that they would only if
the...
Outsized influence already exists.
Exactly. Yeah. I mean, it might have an amplifying effect. Like, there might be other factors that have an amplifying effect on what the media is ultimately doing.
Why does the media have this effect? I mean, I think part of it has to do with how they frame things, right?
Certainly. They framed rather than framing the Iowa caucus as Bernie Sanders received about 26% of delegates or votes, and Elizabeth Warren received 18%, and Buttigieg received 26.5%. They represented as a winner-take-all kind of contest, and they represented as evidence that a particular candidate won first is the candidate that won outright. That the way they frame it is as though the candidate is the candidate that everybody prefers, or the majority prefers. They talk as though that's somehow the case, even when it's just 26%.
It's a tiny plurality.
Right. And it's tiny, and it's, you know, in what should be framed as like the most hotly contested. But they also then in terms of how the candidate performed, it's always relative to a particular set of benchmarks that the media has already set for those candidates. As you noted, it's really the momentum effect, right? It's a way of framing it as they outperformed expectations that we arbitrarily set, often based on very shoddy polling data. And from there, those candidates who outperform their expectations then tend to get more media attention. But also, you can just see the way the media talks about them. particularly the media that happens to be friendly to that the particular party. So like Fox News is going to frame the outcome of the primary very differently from the way CNN is, right? And it's clear that CNN is going to take whoever the winner or whoever, I'd say the vocabulary is so ingrained in the discourse, I'm doing it. That person who happens to have gotten that tiny plurality and talk about them as though they are now the front runner. And for whatever reason, that has serious psychological effects. I wonder, does 538 play a role in this? Like the predictions themselves? I have to confess, in some way, they clearly do for me. I'm, as resident New Hampshire voter, I have this choice to make between two progressive candidates that I honestly, you know, struggled in terms of which one I prefer more. And I'm now in a situation where the polling numbers tell me that I would simply be throwing away my vote were I to vote for one of those two candidates as a result of this 1%.
This is part of the difficulty when talking about the unfairness and thinking about, is there a way to do it better? I worry that polling has a very similar kind of effect. Yep. But the Iowa thing is special. Now, it's interesting. So you said expectations are very important. It's always very important to the media. Did a candidate beat expectations? Like, so if Joe Biden got second and a close second, they would have said, hey, he underperformed a little bit, but not that big a deal. But he was well below expectations. And they take that to be evidence, to be predictive of how he's going to do going forward. I would think independent of their own media bump that they cause. I guess because there's uncertainty about the, as you said, the kind of expectations that are set on the basis of polling data, you might not have high confidence in those, and you take the actual vote to be better evidence of a gauge of how much support Canada has. I don't know, man. It's very messy. Okay, so the framing is certainly part of it. The other thing is there's just an extraordinary amount of attention on the Iowa caucus because it is first, right? Because there's all this buildup for the first one. You want to get that actual action, right? It's a lead up to a, I don't know, a long sporting event, right? There's so much buildup for this tiny little thing that accounts for 1% of the delegates. So you kind of have to make it, I don't know, exciting from the standpoint of the media.
It would be like in the football if you declared a winner after the first drive.
Yeah. Right? First play.
Yeah.
I would say probably the very first play. All this buildup for the very first play. And Joe Biden, it's a loss for, you know, minus 2 yards, rushing yards.
It's over.
Second and 12, you're done. Game's over.
There's no way they will establish the run game.
That's right. So I think that explanation is somehow more to it. It's about the media. It's about the way the media frames it. Now, what's difficult, and I guess this is sort of getting to questions about maybe the unfairness, but why? It seems like we need more information about why this affects voters the way it does. Is it irrational? Is it that they're duped into thinking that Biden is screwed? Because the national polling number suggests he's still comfortably a front runner. Are they duped into thinking that he's screwed and so they get scared away? Is it that Bernie supporters become energized and he's taken to be more viable and so more people show up and vote for him? There's a lot of different things that could be going on here, and it makes it, I think it's very relevant to the question of whether there's some kind of unfairness going on or not. And also, I don't know the answer to any of those questions. Like, why? Why? is it just that, I mean, the general public's just really bad with stats and they don't understand that, like, this is 1%?
Well, or this is the thing, though. The stats by themselves are not as good as predictive models are. The predictive model, Toby, says that Biden is screwed, right? So there's a sense in which they are simply exercising their epistemic responsibilities in a rational manner because they're looking at the best models available to them and they're saying, look, these are what the models tell me. Therefore, I should rearrange my voting practices around the the realities of the viability of my candidate.
So the current Biden supporters in later states watch the news and see the media coverage of Iowa and say, uh-oh, Biden's actually not viable. I have to start thinking about alternatives, where that's kind of an irrational move, because if they just kind of held pat, stood firm.
It doesn't hold. For Biden voters, I don't understand it. Honestly, it's very hard to wrap my mind around what could possibly explain the psychology.
Right, in particular case. Right, if there was like another moderate candidate, and I guess Buttigieg is the other moderate candidate, who looked more viable and was sort of ideologically comparable, you could see them saying, okay, we'll go with Buttigieg, he's more electable, whatever. However, according to 538's model, Buttigieg has only like a 4 or 6% chance of winning, because he polls like at 7% nationally. Like,
right.
It doesn't seem like he actually has much of a chance unless something truly extraordinary happens. So I agree. It's weird. I don't know. I don't understand why it happens in this case, anyways, if it does. And maybe it won't.
This is the Badlands, so we have to kind of believe that that's somehow what's going to happen.
Okay, so I guess we just have to leave that as a question mark. We don't have enough details as to like what voters are thinking, how they're reacting to the media coverage in such a way that it turns out that people who do poorly in Iowa underperform the rest of the way. And again, there are options here, and I think they matter. But what about this claim that, so David Leonhardt says in the subheading, Iowa going first and having this outsized influence is a form of white privilege. And because it's Iowa's disproportionately white. Well, let me just pause right there. I think there's a couple of different things he can mean, because I'm not quite sure exactly why. And he doesn't really elaborate on it too much. But why this is an instance of white privilege. So one possibility, and this has come up in a number of articles, is a lot of people point out that they lament the fact that there are only really, of the viable candidates left, they're all old white people. Well, Buttigieg, a younger white person. And some of them kind of hint at Iowa being partly the cause of that. We could just start there. I don't think that's particularly persuasive in this particular case. So they'll point to Cory Booker and Kamala Harris, or African-American candidates that, you know, had some possibility. Julian Castro being the other sort of major non-white candidate. But if you look into the numbers, I mean, what complicates it here is that a pretty large plurality of black voters support Biden. The older black voters, which is a big part of the Democratic electorate, a very important part of the electorate, tends to be moderate and conservative, and so they prefer Biden. And so while I was looking into this, Booker and Harris did have disproportionately black support. In other words, if you looked at the makeup of the people who supported them, the proportion of black to white voters there was higher than that of other candidates. It still wasn't the case that very many black Democratic voters supported them. They just never had a lot of support in the first place.
So the one counter I can see to, I mean, that observation is certainly seems right, and it probably, it certainly cuts into the idea that the reason those candidates are necessarily out of the race entirely has to do with Iowa and not how they were polling nationally. But you might ask, well, why would a candidate like Buttigieg, who nationally wasn't polling much higher than either of those two candidates, why did he survive all the way up to this point and now see this little surge, which I suspect will go away, but he at least has made it further than those candidates who had comparable national polling numbers. I don't know if they were actually that comparable, but I can see somebody
they
trying
were
to push.
Yeah.
So, and you can see the explanation being, well, he knew that he was going to get this, you know, he had the chance to have this sort of moment in Iowa that those candidates didn't due to the demographic makeup of Iowa. And therefore you at least have some filtering out of candidates based on demographic factors as a result of Iowa going first.
That's fair. And I think probably what's more to the point and what people have in mind is, and people at the time when these were written were reacting to Bernie polling very well, who does fairly well among black voters, but not as well as Biden, not particularly close. It's like 42 to 25. So Bernie is like second among candidates with respect to black voters, but Biden is an overwhelming favorite. The other reason it could be a form of white privilege is because the black portion of the Democratic electorate's preferred candidate, Joe Biden, underperforms there, right? And so it's not so necessarily about the diversity of the candidates themselves, but the preferred candidates of representative demographics do better. How do I put this? You see what I'm saying?
Yeah.
If you had a representative population, the preferred candidate of the representative population would do better than in Iowa, which is a very non-representative population. And so they can say our preferred candidate got screwed over because Iowa is so white. If there were more black voters there who preferred Biden, Biden would have done better and we wouldn't be declaring him dead right now.
Yep.
I take it. That's probably what people have in mind.
So I actually think, so what I've had in mind, there's another interpretation as well, I think, that I'll give you the argument. I'm more convinced of this sort of argument than the sort of necessarily tying it to just directly to the demographics in terms of their role in voting. So why do demographic representation, why does that matter in the first place? Well, obviously, because there are various issues that are of greater concern to some demographics than others. And the sorts of issues that, and this is something that some of the candidates talked about. Julian Castro mentions in one piece that I saw that the kinds of questions he got in Iowa were outliers compared to the other kinds of questions he received pretty much everywhere else that he visited, right? So he talks about like ethanol being this issue that comes up over and over in Iowa that most of the rest of the country doesn't care quite as much about. So there's clear that certain kinds of issues are going to be of greater concern to different demographics. Iowa is very specific in some of the issues that are of importance to it compared to the nation as a whole. But so there are a variety of issues that are clearly going to be of interest to minority communities like criminal justice reform, housing, you know, investment in urban education, all those kinds of things that for Iowa, a small, very white rural state, are not going to be nearly as important as they would be if the first state that was voting happened to have more diverse representation. So another way of thinking about it is it's not really a matter of particular individuals preferring a particular candidate, but the kind of issues that candidates are forced to think about and address in the first vote that has the most influence.
So is it like an opportunity cost issue? Like they could be thinking and talking? Because those Iowa-specific issues, I don't think anyways, very much percolate up to the level of national media. Like I didn't hear much about ethanol and whatever.
Right.
Else.
No, it's more like the issues that a candidate has to be good on,
yeah,
in order to do well in Iowa happen to be issues that are only important to a very specific demographic, namely white rural voters. And so you get candidates who happen to be good on issues that are of interest to specific demographics. So it's really just about the selection effects that come and the kind of issues that matter when selecting for candidates early on.
But then ultimately it's about the relationship between the candidates who do well and the particular portion of the electorate we're talking about.
Yeah.
Okay. Yeah. Interesting. I don't know, however, I mean, if you're talking about unfairness here, it sounds like if you want to talk about being unfair and certain groups having more influence over the other or than another, and you're thinking about like gerrymandering, for instance, as a paradigmatic kind of unfairness, it's a particular kind of democratic unfairness where it's about disproportionate influence, right?
Right.
So I think rather than focusing on race here, because it's not like black voters, for instance, a majority of them prefer any particular candidate, right? Biden leads at 42%, but that means a majority of black voters prefer non-Biden candidates. It would be more to the point, unless people, and I don't think anyone thinks this, people vote because of their race. You say, I'm voting for Buttigieg because I'm white, or I'm voting for Biden because I'm black, right? It would be more to the point to say it's unfair to the supporters of the candidates who aren't going to do well in Iowa. So it's just unfair to Biden supporters, if anyone, right? The whole group of them, because it's going to make it harder for him to win because of the outsized influence. And it seems like it shouldn't, given the mathematical unimportance of the state.
Right. Right. So I think there are different respects in which you can see it as being unfair. I think you can see it as being unfair directly to voters in terms of whether they are achieving proportional representation for the reasons you just gave. I think, on the other hand, you can think, well, there is a form of white privilege that's involved in the selection process, in that because this state goes, various important issues get short shrift. And that's just simply not a good way to select candidates. It's not a morally just or fair way to select candidates. But it's not about the representational harms or the democratic harms, right, that are inflicted upon the voters. Instead, that's more about the consequentialist harms that result from having Iowa go first and thereby impact the issues that end up being most important to our filtering of viable candidates.
So let's talk a little bit about potential unfairness. Just sort of a different way of looking at it. Maybe this is an objection to the idea. Actually, you know what? We should pause. Well, at least I've been billing this issue as potentially complicated, the question of the unfairness, just why is it unfair? People who have defended Iowa going first have often chosen the route of going, literally trying to argue that Iowa deserves to go first. I don't know how the hell you make that argument. That sounds dumb. It's like Iowa exceptionalism, right? They're particularly well suited to having this, you know, incredible influence on the primary. Please.
After this last week.
Yeah.
That's
please.
Hilarious.
I mean, that's a very bad angle to take. But sitting back, I might think to myself, there's a way in which Iowa voters are actually disadvantaged from the standpoint of their influence. And again, I'm kind of thinking about how gerrymandering and the kinds of issues that came up there. And we should be clear, it's not the same as in gerrymandering. And whatever the unfairness is, it's not the same as in gerrymandering. We're literally, because gerrymandering is sort of a post-vote. So a bunch of people vote, and then how you count those varies, right? Depending on where they are at the state level. The kind of influence we're talking about here is pre-vote, which makes it a little bit weirder.
Well, probably the easiest way to get at it is in the gerrymandering episode, we talked about the fact that proportional representation doesn't have this problem, right?
Right.
And as you've said, these primaries are effectively proportional representation systems. So yeah, that's not the issue. Instead, it's some sort of weird causal link historically.
Yeah. It's like who should be able to have this weird irrational effect on the rest of the voters?
Exactly.
And how can we make that go best? Weird. But the reason I bring up gerrymandering is because one of the issues that came up was this idea of wasted votes. And when you have, and there's a sense in which I think, and you don't want to have a wasted vote. If lots of votes are wasted, then that means maybe you're not having the same kind of impact on the process. But one disadvantage that Iowa voters have is that probably in most cases, the maximum number of candidates are in the race during the Iowa primary caucus. And that means that a lot of the candidates that people vote for will just drop out at some point during the race, and their votes and their delegates just disappear. They just don't end up counting for anything. Whereas, as I kind of mentioned before, I might want to be a late state voter. Why? Because I can act a bit more strategically. For instance, particularly during the 2016 Republican primary, I might have wanted to be a late state voter, right? Because a lot of Republican voters would have said anyone but Trump. And this was true. A lot of them did say that. They don't seem to say
the
that.
The majority. Anymore. Like, pretty much the majority.
That's
said.
Right. But you had this question. Jeb Bush, Marco Rubio, Ted Cruz. I don't know, right? If you go later, then you can say, oh, I'm going to one who has the best chance of beating Trump, regardless of who my favorite is. You don't have that luxury if you go earlier on when they're all still in the race and there's more uncertainty. So it's an interesting little trade-off there. Not saying it's not unfair, but there is an informational advantage that people who vote later have.
I have honestly been wishing that we went later since I moved here. Mm. For precisely the reason that I gave earlier, that there are two progressive candidates in the race. I do prefer one to the other. However, I'd be perfectly happy if either one of them was elected. And I would like to vote for the one who's going to end up having the best shot.
Right.
And the earlier you go, the harder it is for you to know whether you're just throwing your vote away if you vote simply for your preferred candidate. And I don't even know, I struggle with what exactly my civic obligations are in this situation, too. Should I torpedo my preferred candidate's chances based on the data? I don't know.
Yeah, I don't either. Yeah. Now, obviously, an obvious alternative to this system is to get rid of the sequential nature of it. And right. And so get rid of these differences in information that people can have. And so you would just have an election primary day where everyone in the Democratic Party in every state went all at once. Now, one question is, why don't we do that? I would guess a big part of it is just because candidates want the time to campaign in a variety of states, like close to when the election happens. I would guess that's a big part of it.
Well, the other thing is, if you have 10 candidates in the race and you do it that way, you might end up with the 10% or the 15% candidate that everybody hates, right? If you have 15 candidates in the race, everybody holds out. And now, the candidate that was just able to get the strongest plurality, even though they maybe were a candidate who was only ever going to get 15 to 20% of the overall support,
right,
wins the nomination and then is not even a viable candidate.
So it kind of, by having it sequentially spread out, you kind of approximate a kind of like ranked choice thing where less, certain candidates will get weeded out and then you can make second choices, et cetera, from there on. Interesting. So that's never going to happen, obviously. Now, the other thing that people have been proposing is like, well, let's have, and we should say a lot of people do defend the idea that there should be a small state that goes first for kind of goofy reasons. It's like, I don't know, small state politics, shucks, aw shucks. It's so nice, right? Going to town halls and doing all these small town things. I don't know. That's the sense that I get. I don't really care about that.
As somebody who lives in it right now, I don't know why we want it. but it's all there are a couple of different angles to go like, oh, well, this makes the political process somehow more intimate. It's like, okay, it makes it more intimate for that one particular group of people.
Yeah.
But it's more alien for everybody else. Why do we want that for one state? Yeah. Why would you think that small towns, again, are going to be representative of the majority of people? That's the bigger thing I have with the bigger issue I have with focusing on small states. Also, small states are much more likely, just like with Iowa, right? There's super specific issues for Iowans that no one else gives a shit about. Ethanol, for example. And the smaller your state is, the more likely that you're going to have some weird geographically specific
special interest that's going to dominate the decision making. Why do we want that?
True. Although, I mean, I would be worried that no matter the size of the state, that's always going to be a problem that you'll have. If you have whatever state you have going first, there are going to be geographically specific interests.
So why do we need a state? Why does it have? Why
that's
isn't
a great
it
super, question.
Why don't Start we kick it off with Super Tuesday? Yeah, exactly.
Yeah, and we should know just to add to the mathematical absurdity of this whole thing, right? Iowa is 44 delegates. Literally 1 month or so from the Iowa caucus, we have Super Tuesday, where there's I don't remember how many states, but it's many that are worth. It's something like what is it, 1,300 delegates or something? I wrote it down somewhere. I'm sorry. It's a lot, all right, yeah, compared to Iowa's 40.
Everybody knows, yeah.
All right, so that's the start of March. And at that point, you really will have a better sense probably of what's going on. You would think you would wait until then, right, before you drastically change your model, for instance, in your predictions. At least I would have thought that. I don't know. This will be a fascinating case study for the effects of Iowa, I think. Because all the other indicators suggest like Biden's still pretty strong. Anyways. There was one other proposal, actually, which you had, I think, a conversation, which was something like, why not just have, like, kind of, like, rolling voting so that, like, starting on February 3rd, you could vote, but you have up until June.
I don't understand why we don't do this for all of our voting.
So that, for instance, if you are a strategic Iowa voter, you're like, I don't know, I don't have a clear preference, but I don't want this person to win. I'm going to wait and see who the more viable possibility is. You wait till your other Iowa voters and the rest of the country voting starts happening, and then you vote accordingly. Something like that would be the idea. I imagine it's for like technical issues, practical barriers.
What? Certainly you couldn't do something like a caucus, right? It eliminates the caucuses. Sorry, Iowa and Maine. Too bad.
There's a few others. I think Washington. I think Washington has one.
Sorry, other white.
It's like a handful.
There's that, but otherwise, is it really that technologically difficult? I mean, clearly, the caucus itself has its own technological difficulties.
Well, dude, this was so funny. So part of the thing we didn't explain, which people are probably familiar with, is part of the reason why things went so badly is because they used this app that was terrible. But my favorite part was like their reasoning for using the app. There was a quote that was like, this is part of Democrats maintaining their technological edge. We're going to use an app in our caucus. Great job.
Yeah. Honestly, the people I feel worst for are the developers.
oh, what? From Shadow? I don't know that I could feel bad for people who work for a company called Shadow.
They're probably sort of outsourced. They probably don't even... They probably work as a contractor.
That's probably right.
At least some of them certainly are.
As long as you want one state to go first, I think you're right. Like that's just gonna you're gonna have these same problems.
So for the rolling sort of voting, don't other countries do that? Don't we effectively do that for
I've never heard of any other country, so I don't know what you're talking about. This is the only democracy in the world, but Michael.
Oh, sorry. But like we allow for people who vote from abroad.
Yep.
To
I can actually vote early in California.
Exactly. People, we have this in some states. It's technologically, it's not a technological limitation that we're facing here.
And actually, this would make a nice compromise with the media, because like the simultaneous voting, the media is going to be like, what do we talk about from February to May? You know, like this is bad for us. They love the primary season, right? It gives you like an event every week or every 2 weeks. It's insane.
If there's one group that we shouldn't compromise with or try to appease.
Well, so this is the other thing, right? We didn't even talk about this, probably because we don't even consider it as a viable possibility. But the media could just talk about this shit differently, right? They could just be like, about 1% of the total delegates are in, and it looks like, Sanders and Buttigieg split a couple each. Cool.
Next up, a panda at the zoo.
Exactly. Exactly.
Yeah. That's not going to happen.
No, I know. They don't even consider it as a possibility as a result.
They need to be completely rewired.
Yeah. No, that's right. It's a whole industry.
So one question I have is, has the Iowa effect been, I mean, there are probably studies in this, like, to what degree is that actually a function of the sensationalization of the news, right? So if you go back historically, did Iowa always have this ridiculously outsized influence back when news was less sensational?
And or more local.
Right.
Yeah, I don't know. That's a great question.
You'd think.
Tweet at us, at the Badlands Pod. Was it different?
The other advantage is, I guess the worry with the rolling admissions thing is you might worry, well, due to the strategic voting thing that you pointed out, most people would then wait until the end, and then you're back in the scenario where the 15%er could win the race somehow, and then you get a totally unviable candidate.
At least you couldn't complain of unfairness.
That's true. But some countries have had problems with proportional representation where they get, like, the white nationalist party to be, you know, close to being in control because they got the 20%. And, of course, 80% of the population despised them, but just due to the split vote.
What about rolling done twice? So you do it like a caucus where you have two phases.
Mm. Oh, that'd be sweet.
Like a runoff thing. I mean, yeah, that's done all over the place.
Yeah.
There's so many good options. It sucks, man.
Well, there's so many clear fixes to many of the problems of democracy. Like, why the fuck does CNN and Fox News get to host the debates?
Mm.
The parties could just bring in actual experts and host the debates themselves. Why are none of these solutions entertained? Like, we could easily have a real democracy if we wanted one. I don't know. So, yeah, that's
one of the most optimistic
change.
Things we've ever said.
Well, yeah, I said if we wanted one.
Oh, right. That's one of the most depressing things we've ever said.
Yeah. Yeah, I don't know.
All right. Well, the primaries are crazy now. As I said, for people who are wild enough to pay attention to the horse race, it's kind of crazy now. As a result of the Iowa thing, which is great for Bernie Sanders supporters, for sure. It's a good outcome for him.
True. It's true.
Again, I'll hold off until Super Tuesday and see how he does in the southern states before I get too excited for a real viable progressive candidate. But we should probably wrap up there. I can no longer talk, really.
You really couldn't at the beginning, so.
No, no. But yeah, have fun. Have fun at the primary.
Oh, I have so many more events to look forward to in the next few days. It's very exciting here.
That's sarcasm.
Yeah. Did I not?
I just wanted to make sure, everyone. Okay. No, it was pretty deadpan. Mm. Anyways, thanks for listening, everyone. Thanks for the chat, Michael. Hope everyone has a great week, and we'll catch you next time.
All right. Talk to you soon.
Thanks for listening to this episode of the Badlands Politics and Philosophy Podcast. If you're enjoying the podcast, you can help it grow by subscribing and by giving it a good rating or a review. And don't forget to check out our website, badlandsphilosophy.com, where you can find a list of citations for every episode and access written content that we post there regularly. If you want to get in touch with us, you can do that through our website, and you can also find us on Twitter at the Badlands Pod. Thanks again for listening.